Welcome to The Lead, the New Lines Magazine podcast. I'm Faisal Yathai, and this is a podcast where we delve into the biggest ideas, events, and personalities from around the world. For the 6 months that the war in Gaza has been raging, English language reporting from the Palestinian territory has been all but impossible to come by. Israel barred international access to Gaza directly after the October attacks, meaning that reporting on the devastating war from inside Gaza was left in the hands of the journalists already there. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, almost 100 have given their lives doing so. We spoke to veteran CNN correspondent Arwa Damon back in November last year in a conversation we called The Emotional Fog of War. It was a conversation that our listeners, and happily awards panels, found highly insightful, and the episode has been nominated for no fewer than 3 awards just in the past 3 weeks. In that conversation, Damon spoke of the need for, and the ongoing failure of, Western reporters maintaining a balanced perspective despite not having that most fundamental element of good journalism, access. Now, Damon has herself been into Gaza, not as a journalist, but as a humanitarian, with Inara, the organization she founded that offers life-altering services to children affected by disasters, whether natural or, as in this case, man-made. After that trip, she published an article in New Lines magazine entitled Gaza in a Million Pieces, in which she described that trip inside what is left of the Gaza Strip. Damon joins us today on The Lead to discuss what she saw and what we might see next. Arwa Damon, welcome again to The Lead.
Thank you for having me.
We should start with your most recent article for the magazine. In it, you wrote, quote, "I watched Gaza's horror unfold on TV and social media and lacked the words to express it. I am here. I am seeing it for myself. I understand so much more, and yet I find myself even more incapable of articulating the extent of what I am witnessing." Given what you wrote there, it's almost an impossible question, but can you try to describe for us what that experience of actually going into Gaza was like?
Yeah, and I'm referring directly to these words that end up sort of framing how war is spoken about. And especially in the context of Gaza, it's words like densely populated, humanitarian crisis, medical infrastructure on its knees. Mm. And going in and having the actual sights and sounds and emotions that are attributed to those words was what really made me realize just how lacking that actual rhetoric is, because how do you describe what is a sea of agony? There are parts of Rafah where, you know, the schools have been transformed into shelters, and every single window, every single railing has clothing and children hanging off of it and out of it, and the tents are spilling out of the shelters onto the streets, covering every inch of sidewalk. There are small stalls that are then placed in the streets themselves, transforming these two-lane roads into one where you can barely pass through a single-lane traffic vehicle. And it's this density of people, of souls that are weaving their way in and out of this among the vehicles, the ambulances, the aid trucks, the donkey carts. And you look around, and what you also realize in those moments is that it's not just the physical killing. It's not just the physical destruction. It's also the psychological killing and the psychological destruction, because people are so traumatized and they're so tired that very sort of energy of life, that vibrancy that so many of us have, that we carry with us, that kind of screams, you know, we're alive, that has all but been eradicated from people. You feel like you're moving through a sea of zombies. And, you know, one woman who I met and ended up being quite good friends with, she said, you know, we're dead. We're dead inside, and we're ghosts. And you really feel like people are just, they're ghosts. And then they're haunted by the ghosts of everything that they've lost.
And how do you interact with people like that? I mean, how do you deal with the daily reality of seeing people in that situation and trying to help them, trying to convey the message to the outside world?
You know, it really depends sort of on the situation where you're interacting with somebody. I always tend to sort of interact in the most, I guess, natural way possible. And by that, I mean, it's hard to describe, but, you know, it's a lot of, how are you? I know that that's a ridiculous question, but how are you holding up? You know, what can I do for you? Because I'm there in a humanitarian capacity. And the thing is a lot of time you don't even need to initiate any sort of an interaction because you get out of your vehicle. And this happened to us in Moesi, for example, which is kind of like this sort of beachfront area where people used to picnic and jog and, you know, make sandcastles. And now it's just blanketed in tents and there's no toilets and there's streams of sewage all over the place. And people see you, you know, in a, you know, INGO, a non-government organization, a charity's t-shirt, and they just mob you. And it's women holding, you know, these limp, listless babies that are just severely malnourished and, you know, kids with fungal infections and rashes and runny noses and fevers and diarrhea and a lot of medications aren't there. So there's people who are, you know, begging for epilepsy medicine for their children and just everything you could possibly imagine. And you walk into these tents and each step you take sort of sends up a cloud of mosquitoes. And because it is Gaza, you end up apologizing a lot.
Yeah.
Because it's not like any other sort of crisis or situation where, you know, and especially for us, like, well, you know, we're a small organization, we're very scrappy and we're very fast. So if I come across, you know, a cluster of people who need diapers, until I can get in a large shipment of diapers, I'm going to run to the closest location that exists and just buy up the entire stock of diapers and give it to them right away. But it's Gaza, you can't do that. And it's the same for just about everything that people need. And then your brain is spinning and running at a million miles, sort of arguing with itself because you're trying to figure out, okay, well, this is the need that I'm seeing here. And then this is the need that I'm seeing here. And how am I going to get this next truck in? And if I put this on the shipment, are the Israelis going to allow the truck to come back inside? And sometimes the interactions are very, I guess, normal and it's almost absurd. So I was talking to this teenage girl in one of the hospitals, and she her foot was amputated. She had these sort of metal rods sticking out of her calf, and I remember walking, you know, kind of at first past sort of where she was staying. And you have to understand that, you know, inside, and this is the European hospital, which is this massive sprawling complex. The corridors are all tents slash shelters. You know, it's just, it's blankets kind of that have been set up and have transformed these like little chunks of space into where people are staying. And the hospital rooms aren't rooms in the sense that you would imagine them to be, where you open a door and walk inside. It's literally a bed sort of blanketed off from the bed next door. And it's miserable. But I walked past this teenager's section, and her smile was so bright. I mean, it lit up the entire space and I was so taken back by it. And I go in and I'm chatting with her, and she's, her brother's completely emaciated, lying on the bed next to her. And she's talking about how the strike came in and it hit the floor that she was on and it killed 11 of her family members and it injured her. But she still has this bright smile on her face to a certain degree. And then the lights went out, the power went out, which is pretty classic. And then in the darkness, she kind of says a little bit shyly, but a little bit cheekily, she's like, "Hey, I like your look. I think it's really cool." And I burst out laughing because it's such a normal kind of, you know, young teenage girl thing to say. And those moments, it's so relieving almost to have those moments and to realize that, you know, those moments still exist in all of it. But it's an impossible situation.
It's almost, I mean, unimaginable, children in pain and amputated limbs and people starving in corridors. And yet actually in the piece, I was struck by how careful you were to put the raw human joy back into the essay. There was one section I thought it was worth quoting for the podcast. You write, there are no rooms here, just bed after bed, cordoned off from each other by blankets. I catch glimpses of love that warm my heart, a sister kissing her younger sibling who has a bandaged leg, a father planting a kiss on his son's forehead. My mind rearranges what it's seeing into the life that was. I can imagine these families in their homes, the children darting off to school, laughter around meals. And I think you obviously felt it was very important to put that human aspect to make sure that that came through in the reporting.
Yeah, I mean, it's very easy to only see the tents and the sorrow and the anger and the gray, you know, the gray of war, the way that gray just colors everything. And I think it's really important to remember that alongside that image, there is the image of the life that was and the life that needs to be. And in some ways, you know, in and of itself, those images, the images that are left, you know, kind of in the aftermath of war, where you see a person, you know, reduced to living in a tent and begging for food. It's very humiliating for them. It's also very dehumanizing for them to a certain degree. And I think, you know, we need to fight back against that and remind people that they once had everything that we have. It might not have been perfect. Gaza was certainly far from perfect. But they had love and life and laughter and all of it. Now I'm going to go back to quoting my my friend again, but she said, you know, what they, and she's speaking of the Israelis, have done is reduced us to the way they want to see us, miserable and living in tents.
I think sometimes when you're describing it, it really sounds like a natural disaster. Like, it's just so such complete destruction. But when you are there, you must realize, like, this is all man-made. This could all have been avoided.
Oh, and that's a very, very powerful realization, and one that you are constantly reminded of, because the drones are constantly overhead, because no matter what part of, you know, Gaza you're in, you hear explosions going off somewhere, you hear the wail of the sirens, but it's those drones that are constantly reminding you that this was caused by man. And you're constantly reminded of that when you see the need and you know that the trucks are there and you know that you...
There. Yeah.
They're there. I mean, you drive past them to get to the border and they're not getting in. And here's the other issue too, is you also realize that, you know, it's about so much more than just counting trucks that cross into Rafah, whether it's from the Rafah crossing with Egypt or from Kerem Shalom, which is kind of what everyone likes to count. It's the, you know, the number of trucks that made it through this crossing. Because those trucks need to move from the warehouse to the population. And that movement has to happen through a process called deconfliction. And that deconfliction process has never and does not work in Gaza. And if anyone needed a wretched reminder of that, it's the strike that happened on the World Central Kitchen convoy, because WCK, I would argue, had the best deconfliction out of any of the organizations working inside Gaza. They had the best lines of communication to the Israelis, which is pretty obvious, because if they didn't, they would not have been able to set up that the temporary pier. They would not have been able to bring stuff in off of their ship. They would not have been able to get to the north. And their convoy was hit, and it just sort of sent these ripples of fear through the humanitarian community, even though, you know, more than 200 humanitarians have been killed in Gaza. This was particularly jarring because it was the World Central Kitchen, because they had the best lines of communication to the Israelis. Mm. So it's not as simple as, you know, let's get the trucks across the border. it's the whole process of then getting the goods to the people that need it.
You have to protect them while they're on the ground. And of course, the World Central Kitchen wasn't hit once, it was hit multiple times.
Yeah. And look, I got in, I think it was 2 days after that hit, with a group of about 30 other, humanitarians working for other INGOs, some on medical missions. And it was all we were talking about.
How did you feel? I mean, you must have been so soon after that happened.
Oh, I was terrified. And look, I'm very accustomed to, because of my, career with CNN and working mostly in war zones, there's always this little kind of like pit of fear that follows you into a war zone. And I actually always say that, one needs to have a level of fear because you need to respect the danger. And that's what keeps you alert, because complacency can get you killed. And usually once you're in a space for a certain amount of time and you start to get a feel for what the dynamics are and kind of the ebb and flow of the battle, as it's called, that kind of pit of fear, it's still there, but it settles. Going into Gaza, that pit of fear was more like a web that sat on my chest and never settled. Like, I do not know how people have been living like this for 6 months. I honestly do not understand how people have not completely and totally mentally just shattered.
I want to ask you a bit about guilt, because you must have felt, you're a citizen of Western countries that are funding and arming the bombing. You must have felt a certain measure of guilt being there.
I mean, you feel guilt over this ridiculousness of having such privilege and going by choice and then being able to leave quite simply by virtue of the fact that you were born, in one piece of land to a father who was born from one piece of land. My dad's American, my mom's Syrian, I carry an American passport. Yeah. And you realize just how absurd that is, that where we're born dictates so much of what we are permitted to become in life.
Yeah.
And it's leaving really when it hits you. Although there was one moment in Gaza, and look, like, I've been to a lot of places as a journalist, and when you go into these, certain areas as a journalist, people do come up to you and they will vent their anger and frustration. So in Syria, for example, we used to get a lot of, well, what's the point in talking to you? What's the point in talking to the media? What can you do for us? We've been talking for years and nothing has changed. And, I'm accustomed to that, and I completely and totally get it. So I was in one area in Rafah, and a man came up to me and he was like, I wasn't really expecting it as a sort of a representative of the humanitarian world. But he was like, what use are you NGOs? And what use are you? And what are you bringing to us? And, the United Nations isn't able to do anything for us. And you're the ones who are representing us there. Obviously, like, I, Inara, are not. But
Yeah. And
that was just, he's right, obviously. And then it's leaving too, because when you leave, you see all of the Gazan families that are leaving, but it's families that are torn apart. It's, a handful that have managed to get on the medical transfer list. And then you have some that are paying these astronomical prices just to get a few members out. It's like $5,000 per person. Yeah. And I was sitting on the bus that takes you kind of through no man's land. And as the bus doors were closing, and it was filled mostly with women and children, this young man jumps through the door of the bus just as it's about to pull out. And his mother was sitting in the front right next to me. And he just gives her this hug and kisses her hands. And she says to him, it's okay. I'm going to be okay. I'm worried about you. And he says to her, I'm going to be okay. I'm going to stay alive for you. It'll be fine. We'll be together again. And I just, the whole bus at that point was kind of crying quietly.
One of our colleagues was telling us that, you know, a lot of the people who are trying to get out of Gaza will be split up from their families, from their children, and they may not see them again for years and years.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't met a single whole family outside of Gaza. You know, Inara does a lot of work with Gazan families in Egypt and in Turkey. They're all split up. And it's an impossible sort of space to exist in, because if you're out, you're alive, but everyone who you love is at risk. You can't heal. You can't even begin to heal. You're sort of in this kind of, you know, frozen, paralyzed life, because everything that you love and everything that you know is still at risk and has been destroyed or could be destroyed. Education is completely frozen. You have, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of, especially this is for, you know, the medical field, you know, young doctors and nurses in all different medical fields who are desperate to get out so that they can finish their education and get their degrees. And the vast majority of them, for example, want to go back and actually be able to practice as professionals. It's really, this war has really targeted every single aspect of life and every single aspect of what it means to be Gazan and Palestinian.
Last time we spoke in November, we discussed the limitations of reporting on the Palestinian side of the conflict. And now you've been inside Gaza, albeit in a humanitarian capacity. What is your assessment of the gap between what is reported and the reality on the ground?
I mean, look, I have so much respect for our Palestinian journalism colleagues. To live Gaza and report on Gaza for 6 months straight without a day off is not something that I can comprehend. Needing international journalists in there is not because Gazan journalists are not up to the job, but it's because the West needs to experience it directly through the lens of a Western journalist and understand it fully and have it presented to them in a way that they cannot dismiss. I think part of the problem is that, you know, Gazans are reporting on their own life and their own people. And as such, there can be a perception, especially in the West, that maybe they aren't as factual as a Western journalist would be.
That perception, of course, you realize is not one that is extended to the Ukrainians in that war.
No, not at all. Not at all. We have to confront our own bias. You know, it's ugly, and, you know, it's a difficult conversation to have with oneself, but we do. And then there's also, you know, you look at the sort of the body of work that Gazan journalists are putting out there, right? It's like endless live shots for broadcasters. It's these short clips on Instagram. It's this and it's that. But what you also need to enhance, you know, on top of that is the longer, more extensive, in-depth pieces, you know, the written pieces that can, you know, really go in and like yank a reader into the experience of it all. And there isn't, you know, capacity to be able to do all of that sort of content. And then the other thing that's a reality too is, you know, Western journalists know a Western audience. You wouldn't necessarily present a story in the same way to a Western audience as you would to, say, an Arab audience. There are certain things that need to be explained and shown to a Western audience that already has a bias or a preconceived notion that you don't need to show to say, for example, an Arab audience, because they already know certain things.
Did you feel that so much of what has been reported from both sides over the last 6 months has just been completely in vain, and nothing has changed? The war has continued, people have continued to die, starvation, amputation, and yet it is a war that is played out nightly on the television screens of the most powerful countries in the world.
In vain? No, definitely not in vain. Because even though the reporting has not had the desired effect, which would be to somehow bring about, you know, an end to all of this, which would be to somehow have rational minds prevail on both sides of this and movement towards a resolution. But in vain, no. There's been a shift in dynamics here. I think it's really important to note that this is the first time that the story of Gaza is being told by Gazans through their lens. And it's not being presented to the West through the lens of the Western media. And social media has really sort of shattered all of that because they are able to directly reach a Western audience through that. And I think that has caused, you know, a shift in psyche and in understanding of what it means to be Gazan and what it means to be Palestinian. And I used to say this about Syria when people would ask me why I kept going back and back and back and nothing was changing. And I think this applies to Gaza as well. You know, even if telling the story doesn't change the present, it needs to be part of the record for the future. It has to be part of the record. This story does not get to be told just by those who have the biggest bombs.
Let's go back to one of the issues that we talked about in our last conversation, which is quite a lot about trauma. We discussed then how there's this perverse incentive structure for politicians to, it incentivizes the continuation, even the cultivation of pain and trauma, because then you can manipulate it for more power. Is that something that you see happening in this case?
You know, when we had that conversation in November, I think back on the things I was saying then, and it's almost as if what's happening now has eclipsed any sort of notion I might have had of the depth and breadth and extent of the trauma that this is causing. I had a mother come running after me when she realized that we also do mental health work with children. And she just grabbed my arm and she was saying, listen, I don't know what to do with my 7-year-old. It's been 2 months now. And every night he screams and starts rocking back and forth and goes into convulsions. And I can't calm him down. And this started after he saw his younger sister's head blown off after a bomb hit our house. And there was the horror of what she was saying and the actual words coming out of her mouth and the image of this, you know, little boy that I had and that whole scene. And then there was how she was saying it. And her voice was very even. You know, she might have been as well been, you know, talking about the weather. And obviously it's not because she's not devastated by what happened. It's because the pain is so deep and so great. It's just, she has clearly just had to shove it down so completely that she can't even allow her voice to crack when she's saying that sentence. Because if her voice cracks, then her entire being is going to crack. And she still has kids who are alive. What's being generated here now, this growing polarization that we're seeing, this pain that is existing throughout, absolutely is at risk of being weaponized. Absolutely.
I think one of the reasons that the previous conversation we had was so well received is because it's rare to hear these kind of meta topics like trauma discussed. And when you're talking about a war, there's a tendency to focus on the daily TikTok of news rather than perhaps the more deeply embedded issues. It is interesting, I mean, just talking to you and thinking back over our previous conversation, now that you have been into Gaza, it does feel like your level of understanding of it has completely been reshaped. And some of the things that we talked about now, they seem so long ago, even though they were only a few months ago. What did you see that made you think, oh, I really have underestimated this or had a smaller understanding of this than I thought I would? Even somebody like you who's been into war zones for a lot of your working life.
Yeah, and I've seen a lot of trauma. I've seen a lot of people traumatized. I've seen the way it actually reshapes a person's features. I've seen the way it just kills that spark in their eye. I've seen the way it sort of steals dreams and childhood hopes. And I've seen it also, obviously, through the work that, you know, I do with my charity. Gaza, I think it was the speed. It was the speed with which it happened, the speed and the intensity. And the fact that there is no safe space. In just about every single other scenario, you know, when you meet someone who is, generally speaking, obviously, but, you know, you meet someone in, you know, the refugee camp, and that's generally, you know, a certain distance away from the front lines. You know, you meet people who are on the run, but they're on the run moving away from danger, even though the path, the road that they're taking might have danger. When you meet people in Gaza, in camps, displaced or on the run, they're not running towards anything that's safer. They're still stuck there. And that adds an entirely different sort of level and depth to all these different traumas themselves. When you can't escape from it, there's no escaping from it. It's relentless. It's around you all the time. And I think that's also maybe why sort of my mind and my eye would always latch on to these, I call them like, you know, these little moments, whether it's two teenage girls, you know, giggling at something off the back of a donkey cart, or it's, you know, a kid cheekily when we're stuck in traffic screaming, you know, I love you through the window because he's showing off to his friends. Or whether it's, you know, children on this, they have these trampolines set up everywhere with kind of meshing around them, and you always find a good crowd of kids inside. And my brain just wants to latch on to that and to not forget that. But even as I'm saying that right now, I'm remembering the hit that took place, you know, less than 24 hours ago, where the Israelis struck a playground that kids were playing in. And it's, I said this before and I'm saying it again, I do not understand how people are able to still keep breathing and keep walking forward, even if they are walking forward.
I wonder if I could ask you to consider the impact of these things on you personally. Like, I wonder, for example, if they affect people differently depending on the professional hats that they're wearing. Did you notice, for example, that you were able to dissociate yourself from the immediate effects of emotion and trauma more effectively as a journalist compared to your now role as a humanitarian?
Well, I think we need to just put it out there that I never disassociate, not as a journalist, not as a humanitarian. And as a journalist, I do not want to disassociate. And I realize that might sound a bit confusing because, you know, we're meant to be objective and we're meant to be observers and this and that and whatnot. I mean, first of all, I think objectivity is just a ridiculous concept because we're all human and no human being is rationally objective. Secondly, I fundamentally believe that when you are confronted with another person's pain and that person is opening up to you and you are telling them, trust me with your story, trust me with your pain, you need to feel a certain measure of it to be able to do it justice. And I would never want to be the sort of journalist that did not feel. As a humanitarian, you absolutely need to feel because you turn that feeling into action, right? As a journalist, you turn those feelings and those emotions into your reports. As a humanitarian, you turn those feelings and those emotions and that sense of urgency. And I guess this is where Gaza is so hard because, you know, you can't do anything quickly in Gaza. But, you know, you turn it into action or you can deliver to someone or a cluster of people or a population what it is that they need. It galvanizes you. It gives you that added determination to just do something and do more. But I've never disassociated, ever.
We talked last time about the importance of bearing witness, of feeling the need to tell certain stories, regardless of the personal cost. I wanted to end by asking you, now that you've been in Gaza and you've put your life on the line to be there, do you still think that there's no alternative than to keep bearing witness?
Absolutely. 100%. 100%.
Ara Damon, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me again.
This has been The Lead from New Lines Magazine. You can find Ara Damon on Twitter at @IAmAraDamon. Her organization, Inara, can be found at inara.org. Next week, my colleagues Lisa Goldman and Kwango Liwewe will be discussing Lisa's recent experiences in Israel for Global Insights on The Lead. This week's episode was produced by Finbar Anderson and hosted by me, Faisal Yafai. For more like this, subscribe to The Lead on your favorite podcast app or visit our website, newlinesmag.com. If you enjoyed this week's episode, please rate us and leave a review as it helps us to grow our audience. And thank you all for joining us.